Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast from ARK Invest. I'm Brett Winton, the chief futurist at ARK and host of the podcast. With me today, I have Chase Prather, the venture associate on the ARK Venture team. And today, Chase, why don't you tell us who we're going to be talking to and what we're going to be talking about, please?
Thanks for the intro, Brett. It's nice to join you. First podcast here at ARK, so excited to dive in. Today, we have Ilya Strebelov on. He is the author of the book, The Venture Mindset. And he's also a professor at Stanford who teaches a class based around private equity principles and venture capital for the last 22 years. So I would say one of the world's leading experts when it comes to private equity principles, venture capital. The book's great. I just finished it actually this morning. So really excited to dive in here.
Yeah. And one of the things that's, I think, reasons why he can kind of make these proclamations about how this stuff works is over the course of his teaching history, he's taught a lot of the founders that have founded the amazing venture companies that we know about today, DoorDash or Airbnb, or because a lot of them go through Stanford Business School. Tell us, give us like a brief, like why the book is interesting from your perspective and what the approach to what the venture mindset is.
I think a lot of these books, especially around venture capital, and I've read all of them, hoping for something new. And I think this is the first one I've read in a long time that has call to actions, things that I can do in my everyday work life, and I can do them today. A lot of the venture capital books are essentially history books that you're reading, and people are telling you about all the success that people are having, but no one ever tells you how they're doing it or the things that you should be looking out for when making these private investments. And he breaks that down, really into 9 key principles to follow. And then there's subcategories underneath each of them. And it's an easy read. It's something you can sit down, and I can't say this about most, self-help books per se, but some of these books, it's a bit of a struggle to get through. This book was, it was fun to read and easy to get through.
One of the reasons why I think it's interesting, particularly now, is because there's so much disruption, from our perspective, technological disruption in the world, and kind of like approaching things with a venture mindset. Think of it as like making good decisions around capital allocation in episodes of high uncertainty. It's like more relevant now than it has ever been. And so I hope you all enjoy the conversation, and we'll go straight to the interview with Ilya Strebelov. With us today, we have Ilya Strebelov. Hi, Ilya. How are you?
Hello, Brett.
Ilya is a professor at Stanford and, as mentioned, has written the book, The Venture Mindset, and has spent his career, thinking about and investigating the venture capital space. Ilya, can you lay out, one, why you wrote the book, and then kind of what are it's kind of a call to action, really, I think. What is it you're commanding both corporations and then capital allocators to do?
Yeah, thank you, Brett. It is indeed a call to action. I think that is a good characterization of the book, and I think that is really the reason why I wrote it. Now, I have been at Stanford for 20 years, and I've been studying venture capitalists, how venture capitalists make decisions, and really everything around the venture capital ecosystem. What I have learned over the years is that venture capitalists, at least smart VCs, smart venture capitalists, make decisions very differently from most of us. including, you know, decision makers in other financial institutions, decision makers in large corporations, in governments, etc. Now, the reason they make decisions differently is not because they're much smarter than most of us, I think, but because they have always been surrounded by a very different environment. The environment, I would say, that can be described as a hostile environment, the environment of extremely high uncertainty, of very high failure. And they had to adapt to that environment in order to survive and succeed. And as a result of that, they came up with different principles. And those are the principles that I call the venture mindset. Now, what I realized, and I think that is critical, is that other decision makers, for example, investment professionals outside the venture sphere, let's say those investing in stocks, but also chief executives at large companies, but also middle managers in large companies, and so on and so on, can benefit dramatically from utilizing many of the applications of the venture mindset principles. So that is really the impetus behind us writing the book, The Venture Mindset, which is to ensure that every single decision maker has in their arsenal tools to make decisions much, much better. Kind of to behave like smart VCs, even if you don't phase investing in startups every day.
Well, okay, so I want to cover like what some of the principles are that people can actually use. And I want to acknowledge or recognize that the principles or venture capitalists exist in a special space in which kind of they have long-term funding. They don't have a lot of, call it external time-based pressure that exists for certainly people in the public equity market where you know the price is shouting at you every single day, and also in the corporate environment where you know potentially you are on the hook for a quarterly bonus. I guess it's kind of a puzzle, but and maybe I'm trying to answer it. Like, why aren't people already making good kind of like expectations and probability adjusted decisions right now within these corporate environments and within the public equity markets?
That's a very good question. And I would say it has been a puzzle for a long time. Obviously, when we look at large corporate environments, so I've been looking at, let's say, corporate innovation or how corporate venture funds operate for years. And many decisions there, frankly, are made very inefficiently. And of course, mistakes that people make in investment environments, for example, when they invest in stocks. So I think there are a number of reasons. The first reason, I would say, are individual biases, which is we tend to make decisions in a particular way. It could be unconscious biases, it could be conscious biases. You mentioned quarterly bonus. That obviously changes our incentives. But also there are psychological biases. And what is really interesting about venture capitalists is that exactly because they don't observe the outcomes of their decisions every single moment, so their feedback loop is relatively long and uncertain, they needed to come up with different types of mechanisms, different types of tools that will help them to dominate those psychological biases, to alleviate those biases. And I think that's exactly what's useful for all of us. Now, in addition to individual decision-making characteristics, there are also group decision-making. So that when we make decisions in groups, now either in corporations or in investment funds, there are investment committees, budget committees, board of directors, and so on, right? And there are a lot of situations in which groups do not make optimal decisions. And again, when I looked at how venture capitalists over the years tried to make decisions in their partnerships, it turns out that they overcame many problems by not just saying, well, we have to do it better, we have to make better decisions in the group, but coming out with very, very specific, what I call playbook mechanisms. And I think, and in my evidence, when let's say I work with large companies, some of those mechanisms can be applied right away in a large company. And I'm pretty sure, let's say, in a by an investment committee or a large investment fund as well. So I think that is, those are the factors that can first explain the puzzle, but also show you how to resolve that puzzle so that we can make decisions more efficiently.
Okay, give us an example. Like, what should a large company be doing? Or even kind of like, how should an organization make decisions kind of with the venture mindset?
So let me just give you an example. One of the principles in the book, which we call agree to disagree. Now, that's kind of a funny name, but what's behind it? If you think about an investment committee that you've been a member of, or any group decision in a large organization, typically it's driven by consensus. So people sitting around the table, and they all coalesce around the decision that everybody agrees on. And again, it's very natural. And by the way, if the decision-making mechanism is not structured in a group, there's a lot of research showing that groups will go towards consensus. In the venture capital environment, consensus, I would say, will not lead to success. Now, my research shows that quite clearly. And the reason behind this is that when you invest in early stage companies, you invest in a lot of failure, but your success is driven by outliers. We call these outliers home runs. And because there are home runs, because there are outliers, it means that when you invest by consensus, likely those consensus-driven investment decisions will not lead to a home run. Like, if everybody knows it's a great idea, likely its value already is going to be pretty high. And therefore, likely you will not get a home run level returns. So what venture capitalists realized very early on is that conviction beats consensus every single time. And as a result of this, they allowed in their partnerships make decisions or structure decision-making process in a way that alleviates this consensus challenge. So let me give you some specific examples. For example, so one day, about maybe 15 years ago, a guy called Reid Hoffman, who's a partner at a venture capital firm called Greylock, came to his partnership and said, look, guys, I found out an amazing startup. There are two founders, and in this startup, what they're offering is a platform where you can allow strangers to sleep on a couch in your living room, and those strangers will pay you money for every single night. Okay? What a cool idea. Well, all the Greylock partners looked at each other, okay, at this partnership meeting, and they said, we've never heard the dumbest idea. Like, that was the dumbest idea we've ever heard. So in most groups, that would have been the end of the story. Like, every single partner was against investing, despite the fact that Reid Hoffman was very excited. But the consensus was obviously against investing. But that's not how Greylock was structured. And despite the fact that consensus was against, in the Greylock VC partnership, they allowed a single partner to make an investment decision if he was truly passionate about this investment. So Reid Hoffman proceeded. And on behalf of Greylock, on behalf of all those partners that disagreed with him, invested in a company that turned out to be Airbnb and turned out to be a pretty successful deal for Greylock. So I think that is a very clear example of conviction beating consensus.
The way I think about it is if you have, there's a distribution of outcomes, and if you have a really consensus-based decision-making process, you end up in the center of that distribution, but you lose the tails of the distribution. So if all of your return is in the tail, the outliers, then you effectively, with consensus, clip out those outliers. And you probably, you know, you miss some zeros, so the left end of the distribution, which within a corporate environment might actually be important, at least if I'm trying to manage my own kind of political risk. In some ways, it's like, consensus works if you're trying to kind of manage your downside, whereas it fails if you're trying to access upside. Is that the right way to think about it?
You know, it's a very interesting, Brad, because I would have said that in normal situations, that is the right approach, which is when we face the situation, let's say in a corporate environment of static situation, which means that there is no uncertainty, no dynamic, no big changes, then in fact, I think consensus is a smart strategy. And I think that is also one of the reasons why in corporate, traditional corporate environments, we've kind of migrated towards consensus over the years, in addition to our human nature that drives towards consensus. The challenge is that this is not just about outliers, which of course the venture capital business is about. It's about the dynamics. So when the situation's shifting, so let's say you're in an industry that is being disrupted. So let's say you're in an industry where there are new competitors. So these days, everybody's talking about AI, but from the point of view of a traditional corporate player, AI is affected as a new factor that is shifting the dynamic in your industry. So the moment this is happening, this is exactly the situation where you don't want consensus. Because you would like to hear opinions and you would like to make decisions that are based on not just outliers, but on some additional new unusual thinking. And typically this thinking is not going to come even forward, not just win, in a corporate environment, in any group decision, when you strive for consensus. So I think here is the bottom line for corporate leaders. If you're in a very stable environment, consensus is a great idea, okay? Proceed as you've always done. The moment there is an unstable environment, then stop what you've done before and use the venture mindset. So that is definitely my advice.
The way I think, I mean, this environment right now, both geopolitically, macroeconomically, and technologically, is probably, there's probably more uncertainty in the world than, I mean, certainly in my lifetime. And I think you have to, I don't know how long you have to go back to like identify a similarly kind of momentous like piece of history. But it seems like you need this approach now more than ever.
Absolutely. And I think just to support what you've said, Brett, this is not just about a lot of uncertainty in the world, more than, you know, in the past 50 years, perhaps. But I think what is equally important is that this uncertainty is coming from so many different angles. It's not just that one source of uncertainty that we can go explore carefully, they're trying to predict, reach consensus about it. But there are a lot of sources of uncertainty. And I think we just don't have an ability, either in a corporate environment, okay, or in an academic environment and so on, to explore every single source. In the past, I think, if you were in a stable industry, most industries were very stable, it was relatively straightforward to predict the growth rate or the technology development in your industry in the next 5 years. Yes, there was some noise. Yes, there were some mistakes, but on average, I think it worked. Well, try to predict the technology development, the growth rate, the competitive environment, the geopolitical environment in any industry, whatever industry you are, in the next 5 years. I think most corporate leaders will agree that it is now much, much more difficult, if not outright impossible. This is exactly the environment where you absolutely must use the venture mindset.
If you were to kind of invert kind of your prescriptions and say, hey, I'm going to look at different companies and try to, from an outside perspective, judge, you know, how well they are geared to using this to make decisions. How would you go about that?
You obviously need to know first who the leader is and the characteristics of the leader. Because I think that when we think about leaders who follow the venture mindset, those are the leaders that first are more willing to accept failure. Now, I can give you a famous example that we also use in our book. For example, Jeff Bezos, when he was the CEO of Amazon, he was known to tell all the time that as we grow, the size of our failures also must grow. And he, in fact, apply this in practice. So the leader who is more acceptable, more likely to embrace failure, experimentation, and I think if you are trying to understand, especially public companies, as an investor, you don't need to be Jeff Bezos, or the leader should not be Jeff Bezos for you really to understand whether the leader is venture-minded. You know, it's really interesting because in our book, we have 9 principles of the venture mindset. And each principle, I would say, is possible to empirically validate, which is effectively, I think for most of the principles, you can actually check whether the leader or the company is following those principles. For private companies, it's likely much more difficult to do if you're outside the private company. I think for public companies, it is possible to do. Let me give you another example. You mentioned early on about the challenges of public companies where very often they live from a quarter to quarter. Now, but in fact, those are not all public companies. There are many public companies that develop very successfully long-term incentives. Not just long-term incentives, but also incentives that centered around the job that a specific person is doing. So let's say, you know, if let's say I am an employee of Alphabet, and I'm giving Alphabet stock. Well, unless I'm the CEO of Alphabet, I don't really have a lot of impact on Alphabet stock, right? Now, but if you give me what I call a shadow stock, whose value will depend on the value of a specific project that I'm doing. Well, let's say I work in Waymo, which is a subsidiary of Alphabet. Then my impact is larger. And so, in fact, there are a lot of companies that follow the long-term incentives. This is another principle of the venture mindset, which is make the pie bigger. But again, the whole point behind this make the pie bigger, it's a beautiful, beautiful phrase, is a specific mechanism that venture capitalists use. And we observe, and actually in our book, we give a lot of examples of specific companies that use those principles in a very, very specific, venture-minded, thoughtful way. And this is observable, at least for public companies.
Yes, it's observable. And kind of, I think the Waymo example is an interesting one where the individuals who spearheaded Waymo early on, you know, collected a lot of compensation off of getting the project to a certain level. But at least as from an outsider's perspective, it seems like there's not a sense of urgency that there is inside of Waymo as a subsidiary to a larger kind of Alphabet corporation, as there might be for kind of Tesla, where the overall kind of like enterprise value is heavily geared to successfully scaling robotaxi. It seems like corporations inevitably move or Amazon as well, inevitably move from more VC style mindset thinking as they are like accessing opportunity to a more defensive minded kind of like protecting what we have, which then ultimately like clips off these continued like reaching for innovation. Is there something they can do to guard against that? And do you agree with that framing? Do you think it's inevitable that you move into bureaucracy and kind of like box checking as opposed to creative endeavors?
That is a great question. No, it is not inevitable, but yes, there is a tendency to do so. And the tendency to do so is relatively clear why that is the case, especially for successful companies. It's because a successful company, by definition, has a profitable cash-generating product or service. And obviously, every single company is trying to protect that cash flow-generating product or service. And as you're protecting, as you're saying, if it's you're taking a defensive stance, and defensive stance very often leads to anti-venture mindset behavior, okay? Now, that is not inevitable. The way to think about this is to think about every single organization, every single company as a portfolio of bets. And I tend to think about the 3-layer pyramid, which is portfolio of 3 types of bets. Imagine the pyramid, where at the bottom of the pyramid, there's a large slice, and that is your current cash flow generating business. And I call it run, because this is what you're running right now, okay? That is, let's say, for Alphabet, that is Google. That is Google search engine, let's say. Then the middle layer, which is smaller but also large, is the adjacent layer, which shares the same business model, as for the bottom layer for the run, but it introduces some incremental innovation. For example, let's say for Amazon, you have an e-commerce platform. When you are introducing the Prime service, that is going to be in the adjacent space. That is certainly an innovation. That is a different paradigm, but it's within the same business model that you're operating. And then at the top of the pyramid, typically it's the smallest kind of piece, is what I call new or disrupt. And those are the bets that are disruptive innovation. And they change either the business model or have the potential to change the business model. They have the potential to change your customer. They have the potential to change the relationship with your customer. Going back to Amazon, a clear example there was AWS. So when AWS was identified by Bezos and others as a potentially interesting project, it had little to do with the e-commerce Amazon platform. It had little to do with all those adjacent changes that Amazon was introducing every day or every month. And yet, Amazon proceeded with that different bet. In fact, Amazon proceeded with a lot of bets. Some of them were very successful in this new disrupt space. So AWS, Alexa. Some of them were, I would say, very unsuccessful. Let's say Fire Phone, when Amazon tried to compete with Apple and failed. Now, the reason why Amazon was able to do so, I think, is because they approached this run and this new bets differently. So the way for every single company, and I observe a lot of companies that are venture-minded, is that when the leaders consider their companies as portfolio of bets, they identify the bets that are about future disrupt, and they put them in a separate category. Now, there are many ways to do this. Sometimes you can do it within the same company as Amazon did. Sometimes you can do it in separate companies. This is what IBM did, you know, I guess 30, 40 years ago when IBM's leader came in. IBM was losing the PC market, even though IBM invented PC. And the solution was to create a new, completely independent PC business. So IBM was back then a mainframe company that was located thousands of miles away. Another possibility is to create an internal unit, like a corporate venture fund, that is looking outside. So again, it's a part of the disrupt scheme. Of course, the challenge there is that you have to create it in a very, very smart way. So I've been analyzing almost every single corporate venture fund in the United States and many corporate venture funds abroad. And unfortunately, many of them are not designed with the venture mindset principles in mind. But some of them are. And once you design them with the venture mind's principles, it is really like an outside look that will help you to find new bets. It also might help you to protect against risks that can attack your bottom line, your run. But I think more importantly, it can find you some new bets that you are well positioned to take care of in this unstable environment. So the bottom line is, there are actually a lot of ways for corporations, especially large, successful corporations, to introduce the venture mindset in their midst. But you are right, Brett, is that the tendency, if you are not going to do anything, the tendency for large corporates to become very conservative, very risk-averse, and are much more likely to be losers whenever the environment suddenly dynamically changes.
In the book, you mentioned that one of the main reasons corporate VC arms typically don't have great returns is tied to them not getting outside of the four walls. Their networks are often very curated, small. Even if they have 1,000 connections that are great, they're typically within, you know, few companies. Would you say that's the main reason, or are there other, you know, core reasons that make them less successful than traditional VC?
Well, there are many reasons. Getting outside the four walls is only one reason. And indeed, it's a big reason. You know what I did? I looked at, let's say, LinkedIn connections of institutional venture capitalists, those that invest on behalf of their limited partners, their investors, and corporate venture investors, those that invest outside their company, but on behalf of their company. And it turns out to be not only that corporate VCs have much smaller LinkedIn connections, which perhaps is not surprising. But also, they're much more circumscribed, so that they're much smaller in terms of diversification. So that, you know, you tend to be connected with your colleagues, maybe with your colleagues at your prior work, with your classmates in the college, and so on. While VCs are connections are going to be much more diversified. And of course, it's not only about LinkedIn connections, it's about your communications. You're trying to find new ideas. Now, if it's true about corporate VCs, Chase, that's likely even truer, even more true, about corporate executives who work inside those four walls. But I think that is only one of the reasons. Let me give you another reason. So another principle in the book we call Say No 100 Times. A fancy title. It comes from my research, which is what I found out with my colleagues, is that for every single deal that smart VCs make, they pass on at least, sometimes more, than 100 investment opportunities. Okay? When we look at many corporate VCs, that is not the case. They have much narrower pipeline, much more, I would say, less interesting deal flow, deal funnel, so that maybe they will make investments that somebody will bring to them. So it's not one out of 100, but maybe, you know, one out of 10, one out of five. And that also leads, on average, to much worse investments. In fact, as a result of that, they are much more likely to miss the best deals. Another reason why, in my research, corporate VCs really have problem is this principle of agree to disagree I talked about earlier. You know, most corporate VCs are structured in the following way. There is an investment committee within a corporate venture capital unit, like a partnership in a venture capital fund. And then the deals that they think are interesting, they're going to bring to the second layer investment committee of the parent company. That investment committee can have 5 to 7 to 8 members, and it consists of parent company executives, CEO, CFO, CTO, CMO, sometimes general counsel, sometimes president of a business unit, and so on and so forth. By the way, in 2/3 of the cases, nobody from the venture capital fund, from the corporate venture capital fund, is not on that parent-level investment committee. And that parent-level investment committee very often unanimously has to approve a decision. So now imagine bringing a very, well, going back to my early example, Airbnb, to a parent-level investment committee of a corporate venture fund, let's say, of a hotel industry. Well, very likely, that will not pass the muster of that committee. What really happens, though, it's really interesting and very important to understand if you happen to manage corporate venture fund or if you are the CEO of a large company, is what I call pre-selection, which means that those who work in the corporate venture unit, they know that those Airbnb-like deals are very unlikely to be approved. So they don't bring those deals. As a result of that, most corporate VCs that are structured like I described, their parent executives even don't see the deals that potentially are outliers. And this brings another interesting venture mindset principle or application called the anti-portfolio, which means deals that you kind of looked at, that you had access to, but you decided not to invest or you could not invest. And if you look at many corporate VC funds, it turns out that because of their dual structure that I described, their anti-portfolio is performing much better than their portfolio. And some companies within that anti-portfolio that they really had the chance to invest, they are going to come and disrupt the parent. So that is the challenge of many, many corporate venture initiatives.
I mean, I could kind of imagine it even being the company that's going to disrupt the parent company will be less likely to invest in, since there's like a set of antibodies in the organization that have an allergic reaction to that idea in some ways. It's so threatening to the core way in which they operate and the way they generate cash flow that kind of like it produces like a, I don't know, a characteristic closed-mindedness or defensiveness against the kind of like way in which business is being approached.
I agree with this. There's a name for it. In the book, we call it NIH syndrome. NIH stands for not invented here. So that if you bring something to the company, and that is not a product of the company's creativity, many people in the company will say, well, we can do the same. We can do better. We can do it faster. And by the way, it might be true. They just will never, ever do it. And I think that many companies around the world failed exactly because of NIH principles. We give a lot of examples in the book. But again, Brad, it's about the how the leaders of the company structure their decision-making process. Indeed, if you need to ask permission to invest or develop any project, by the way, it's not just about corporate venture, it's also about corporate intrapreneurship. Your higher-ups, then these higher-ups likely will have NIH, not invented here syndrome. But I think some companies very actively try to counteract this. So think about Microsoft in the last 12 years after Satya Nadella came and became the CEO. I think this is the clearest example of a venture-minded organization and the venture-minded leader that on purpose investing in deals that I think, you know, follow the NIH and potentially disrupting internal business. So everybody's talking about Microsoft's investment in OpenAI, for example, okay? But if we step back for a second, first, it's a clear example of the violation, a positive violation of the NIH syndrome, which is a large company investing in something that is not developed there, and not every single tech company is able to do it. And by the way, Microsoft in the past, I think, was not able to do it under the previous leadership. And second, it's an example of a situation where you invest in something that is likely to disrupt you. And so now we kind of know quite clearly, I think, that AI players such as OpenAI can disrupt, in maybe the nearest future, large tech players. It likely was not obvious, you know, 2 to 3 or 4 years ago, but I think Microsoft was structured in a way where you can invest. Now, not tens of billions of dollars at the time, it was hundreds of millions of dollars, or tens of millions of dollars, in the play that potentially can disrupt you. It may or may not. Now, we know typically the examples of success. The whole point is there are also many, many examples where you invest, where there's a possibility of disruption that doesn't take place. So here's an example of a company that I think structured its way, despite the fact that it was a very conservative company, that it relied on a very specific, I would say, narrow range of extremely profitable products, and I think suffered from all the challenges of large companies. Here we have a leader who came and changed the culture, changed the structure of the company, changed the decision-making process.
It's also a leader, his compensation was really tied to kind of the growth of business units that weren't kind of the core business unit. So it goes back to your point on incentive structuring. Even at the CEO level, if the CEO is only incentivized on stock price movement, that encourages a certain kind of behavior that's actually not necessarily strategically optimal for the company.
I absolutely agree, which is especially if incentives are short term. So if you're incentivized on the stock price behavior of the next quarter, that could be a challenge. Even though stock price indicates the long-term value of the company, but we do know, and there's a lot of academic research on this, that there are challenges with the short-term incentives. So the incentive should be long-term, but then also the incentive should be structured in two additional ways at least. One is that the leader has an impact on the dynamics of the change. And second is that especially in this environment where you would like the company to grow or develop new businesses, the incentives should be somewhat biased towards new business products, new business units. And I think that's what happened in Microsoft. And by the way, it's happening in many other venture-minded organizations.
This is all tied to leadership, which is another principle in the book that you talk about, backing the jockey, not the horse. And a question I have around that is just understanding, you know, what are some key things that you use to identify, a great founder versus, you know, a really good founder? What separates the top 1% of the 1% from the 1%?
Yeah, well, that is a $1 billion question that every single venture cap is trying to answer. Before that, let me step back. And yes, one of the important venture mindset principles is bet on the jockey, not just the horse. Because in a large corporate environment, very often we decide on the project first, which is the horse, and only then we say, well, who's going to do it? And I'm, you know, every single time I present this to, when I lead strategic offsites of large companies, I give an example and everybody is nodding. Like I said, do you remember last time, recently, when you were in a presentation where there was a 100-page deck with a lot of discounted cash flow, growth rates, multiples, et cetera, of a specific project. But that those 100 pages do not contain a single name of who is, in fact, going to do it. Okay, oh, somebody is going to do it within our company, but we never ask the question who. If we look at venture capitalists, they, in fact, first choose the jockey. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to, you know, invest in a jockey that is trying to develop a market that doesn't exist or the horse that has no chance. But we will not invest as venture cap, smart VCs, on a horse that does not have a good jockey. Because it's not really about the idea, but who is going to implement the idea. For every single good idea, there are so many teams that are trying to implement it. Now to your question about, well, what is a good jockey? So here are some lessons from my observations of so many VCs. First, charisma. Now, charisma is something that people very often mention, but something that is rather difficult to operationalize. But here's my attempt of operationalizing it. When you think about founders of startups, they typically have no resources. They have no funding yet. And if they're able to attract a lot of smart employees early on, when they have just the idea, then something in them that everybody is trying to follow. And by the way, I taught thousands of students at Stanford, and I work with a lot of my students. I meet with them, I help them, I advise them. And you know, sometimes, not very frequently, but sometimes I had students come into my office, tell me about the idea. And they have a charisma in the following way, that in fact, I feel inside me that I would love to drop whatever I do and I would love to follow them. And I think that is the way you operationalize charisma. Charisma is something that when people would like to follow you, the smart people, the best people. So that's one. Another important characteristic that VCs look for is resilience. And I think resilience is critically important because if you think about startups, then every single successful startup, at least once, was at the death door, at the point of almost failure. And founders who are the CEOs of those companies have to make tough decisions, especially in those situations. And I think resilience is something that VCs are trying to look for. And again, it's applicable to large companies in a corporate environment. Another example is very often we have co-founders, and the relationship within the co-founding team is critically important. Very often VCs will not invest if they observe there is a strange dynamics, I would say uncomfortable, unfriendly dynamics among the co-founders. So those are just three examples. And, there's something that is remarkable, which is what matters less. In a stable environment, I think, what matters most is the expertise. So that, how much do you know about this stuff? in an environment of very fast change. Now, of course, expertise, you know, also matters, but I think it matters less than other qualities. Because very often, you can learn very fast the new topic, the new space. So let me just give you a couple of examples. You know, Tonio Hsu, the co-founder of DoorDash, he had no experience in logistics, optimization of food delivery. And by the way, he was in my venture capital class back in, I think, 2013 or 2014. Or, you know, Brian Chesky or Jeba, they had college degrees in industrial design, which obviously was not directly applicable to their startup. Okay. And I can give you many, many other examples. By the way, it's even true in healthcare. An example, there's a company called Flatiron Health, which is cancer care. Well, if you look at the founders, they came from Google. They didn't have directly healthcare experience. So there are a lot of situations where current expertise matters less than other characteristics. And again, I think it is downplayed very often in large corporate environments.
I wanted to drill in real quick on one point that you said around having structure organizationally amongst co-founders. And in the book Founders Dilemmas, they mention one of the key reasons, I wouldn't say key, but a reason that companies will fail at an early stage is because they don't have a hierarchy amongst co-founders called the co-CEO, and both of them want to be the top dog. Is that something that you've seen as well within your research?
Absolutely. When I say an unfriendly dynamics among the founders, this is my way of saying that if every single co-founder wants to be the top dog, it inevitably will lead to a conflict, inevitably. And sometimes this conflict could be resolved successfully, sometimes it couldn't. You know, many venture capitalists who join the board of startups, very often they play the role of a psychotherapist, kind of, that they're trying to resolve various challenges among the co-founders. But even better if they try to resolve those challenges before they invest, or they try to understand whether those challenges are definitely going to come up before they invest. So absolutely, I observe this firsthand.
I want to pick on one thing where I have a question and then talk about the general operating environment right now. The idea that kind of like a contrary to consensus, you know, position is going to work both makes intuitive sense and it runs up against the rocks of private businesses have their own sort of momentum, and people often use social proof within venture to decide whether or not they're going to invest. It's like, I'm investing in this because there's this other tier one venture team investing, and that seems kind of like, obviously you're paying a higher price because they're already in, but it also means that the company likely has very, you know, strong capital behind it through whatever bumps it hits in the road. Are those two ideas in opposition, or are they reconcilable, or how do you think about that dynamic?
There are in some opposition to some extent, which is obviously what you're describing is, I would call it FOMO, fear of missing out. If a top investor is investing in the company, well, I'm afraid that if I don't invest, then likely I'll be a loser. But now, research in fact shows that if you're just trying to follow top investors, you are less likely to be successful, because very often you will not be able to follow. And also when you follow it at a very different valuation, which is you are less likely to co-invest, likely you will be investing in the subsequent rounds, which are going to be at a very high valuation. The principle of conviction beats consensus is that you really need to be able to develop your own thesis. Now, your own thesis does not need to be completely separate from what top investors are doing. It could be maybe in a similar space, but you know, especially in a new dynamic environment, in a new space, there are so many different subspaces that could become very successful. And as a result of that, I think what smart investors are doing, they are not just trying to imitate top investors. They are trying to, what I call, and that's another principle of the venture mindset, prepare their mind and try to identify new opportunities that not yet everybody is trying to pursue. Like once everybody is trying to pursue an opportunity, likely that means that you're already too late.
The current operating environment, I mean, we're all familiar with what's happening with AI and really across technologies. You know, technologies are cutting across sectors. We think that literally more than $100 trillion in value will accrue to disruptive technologies over the course of this business cycle. Does kind of like the technological tooling that's being introduced change kind of like even how people can operationalize a venture mindset? Like, should we be using AI to help us do this stuff? Or is AI as kind of a consensus mechanism going to actually, you know, further clip out the tails of the distribution that are potentially interesting?
It's very difficult to predict the future, but I will try. I think that AI could be very useful for the venture mindset process, to improve the applications of the venture mindset. Because at the end of the day, what the venture mindset process is you have to follow the process, you have to gather a lot of information, you have to structure the decision-making environment in the right way. And I think that AI is going to make it much better if you use it correctly. At the same time, the very last point on when people are going to make decisions, at this point, I don't see how AI is going to make decisions. I know that everybody's talking about, you know, general intelligence and so on. And of course, it's impossible to predict the future. I somehow doubt that in the foreseeable future, AI will be able to make better decisions than human beings about an unstable environment. I think in the stable environment, AI is much better already because it's purely computational at the end of the day. But the moment there's a lot of intuition that follows all these venture mindset principles, many of which are, I think, relatively easy to operationalize, but very difficult to quantify or very difficult to code, it's still the end of the road depends on specific people. So that's why I do think that every single executive who is listening to us, do not rely only on AI. Make sure that you digest all those venture mindset principles and also ensure that all the people around you digest those principles as well.
Well, thank you very much, Ilya, for joining us on the FYI podcast. The book is The Venture Mindset. It really is, I think, useful and operationalizable for individuals, for people inside organizations, for investors, and kind of offers a fascinating viewpoint into kind of how decisions are made and not being made well sometimes within corporations and investing organizations. So really appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brett. Thank you, Chase. Great discussion.
Chase, final thoughts on Ilya and the venture mindset, please.
I would say my final thoughts. One, he's a guy I could learn from all day. I still have a list of maybe, you know, 10 questions I would love to sit down and ask him. You know, I'm sure all the students show up to his class every day and just want to pound him with questions. You know, overall, great conversation. Tons of valuable insights that you can go and, you know, put into your everyday life. As I mentioned before, it's just very actionable, his teachings, and I appreciate that.
To me, I think that there is there's something extraordinarily provocative in kind of like having to guard against humans' natural biases to be like, oh, I'm in agreement with everybody, and then therefore I'm safe, where that's actually the riskiest spot to be within certain operating environments. And so it really is critical to both when you're assessing investments and thinking about how you structure decision-making in your organization to set up good frameworks that guard against that safe thinking that actually is taking a lot of risk that you don't even know you're taking. Both risk of omission, you're not making the decision that could be the maximally returning decision spread across a number of portfolio bets, and risks of kind of getting disrupted. And for a lot of companies, I think that that's the operating environment that they're suddenly in. And they're still trying to play this playbook that has worked for 20 years or 40 years or 100 years. And kind of the operating environment has shifted under their feet. And so therefore, kind of over the course of this business cycle, suddenly that playbook might look catastrophically narrow-minded. And so I think it's, you know, given what's happening with AI and robotics and energy storage and, you know, multi-omics and blockchain, like there's a lot of ways the playing field is changing. And so it'll be interesting to see if companies can kind of operate in that environment when it's potentially very contrary to what has been the best state of operations in the world to date. This has been FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. Thank you much for listening, and please like and subscribe and rate us 5 stars because that's how other people learn about the podcast. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.